From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. It's been 50 years since Schoolhouse Rock appeared on Saturday morning TV to teach kids about math, grammar, and history using catchy tunes and friendly animated videos. Today, we listen back to portions of our interviews with some of the people behind those songs. Composer, pianist, and singer Bob Dureau was recruited early on to write for Schoolhouse Rock with the advice not to write down to kids. Songwriter and pianist Dave Frischberg wrote the song I'm Just a Bill, and trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon can be heard on that song, as well as Conjunction Junction and others. Also, Justin Chang reviews Magic Mike's Last Dance, the third Magic Mike film starring Channing Tatum. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last month was the golden anniversary of Schoolhouse Rock, the series of animated musical shorts that aired on ABC from 1973 to 1984. If you don't know how many years ago that was, you may not have watched enough Schoolhouse Rock. Like Sesame Street, which had premiered on public television 4 years earlier, Schoolhouse Rock set out to use catchy music and friendly visuals to teach kids about things, like whether the word thing was a noun or a verb. Each Schoolhouse Rock segment was a 3-minute interstitial cartoon inserted between ABC's other shows on Saturday morning. The subject of the first series of cartoons was Multiplication Rock, followed by Grammar Rock, America Rock, Science Rock, Money Rock, and Earth Rock. The songs in those series included a number of informative earworms that educated young viewers in the 1970s and beyond, songs such as I'm Just a Bill and Conjunction Junction. An advertising agency, McCaffrey & McCall, came up with the idea, commissioned a composer to write a song featuring multiplication tables, then took the song and animation storyboards to ABC. At the time, network TV was under increased scrutiny by politicians and watchdog groups, and the head of ABC Children's Programming eagerly made room for Schoolhouse Rock. That young ABC executive, by the way, was Michael Eisner, who later became CEO of the Walt Disney Company, which now owns ABC. Schoolhouse Rock won 4 Emmys, and some of its songs have persisted in pop culture. Last week, ABC presented a primetime special, Schoolhouse Rock 50th Anniversary Sing-Along, with guest stars singing new renditions of old favorites. Here's the rapper Ne-Yo on that new special, singing his version of Verb, That's What's Happening.
I get my thing in action, to be, to sing, to feel, to live. Put my heart in action, to run, to go, to get, that's where I find satisfaction, to search, to find, to have, to hold, when I use my imagination, I think, I plot, I plan, I dream, turning it towards creation, I make, I write, I I sing when I'm feeling really active. I run, I ride, I swim, I fly. Other times when life is easy, I rest, I sleep, I sit, I lie.
Today on Fresh Air, we salute the 50th anniversary of Schoolhouse Rock, that's 5 times 10, by revisiting an interview with Bob Dureau, the composer who wrote and sang that original tryout song for Schoolhouse Rock, 3 is a Magic Number. Dureau was hired immediately as music director for the series and wrote all the songs for the initial short cartoons presented as Multiplication Rock. Here's a taste of one, written and sung by him, about the number 5.
Now everybody try to find a good hiding place. This old tree is going to be the base. I'm going to close my eyes and hide my face and count to 100 by 5s. Ready? Go.
5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, 60, 65, 70, 75, 80, 85, 90, 95, 100, ready or not, here I come. Apple, peaches, pumpkin pie, who's not ready, holler I. Oh, all right, I'll count it again, but you better get hit, kid. Here we go. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, 60, 65, 70, 75, 80, 85, 90, 95, 100, 101, 105, 110, 115, 115, 120. There. A bushel of wheat and a bushel of rye. Who's not hit? Holler I. 20 nickels makes a dollar. I didn't hear anybody holler. 5 times 20 is 100. Everybody got to be hit. All eyes open. Here I come.
Bob Dureau, who died in 2018 at age 94, had a life and credits far beyond a Saturday morning children's show. At one point in his musical career, he played piano between comedy sets by Lenny Bruce. He recorded a Christmas album with Miles Davis, providing vocals as well as lyrics. He co-wrote with Ben Tucker the much-covered song Comin' Home Baby, and collaborated with everyone from Hoagy Carmichael and The Fugs to Art Garfunkel and Nellie Mackay. Terry Gross spoke to Bob Dureau in 1996 when a roster of artists who grew up singing his songs, including the Lemonheads and Blind Melon, recorded a tribute album called Schoolhouse Rock Rocks. She asked Bob Dureau how the original animated series came about.
Well, let's see. I had met the advertising people who concocted the idea. And my partner, Ben Tucker, in fact, wanted us to write a little advertising music. He's a bass player, Ben Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
So one day, this gentleman from McCaffrey and McCall Ad Agency said, "We're looking for a guy to put the multiplication tables to music." And Ben Tucker said, "My partner, Bob Dureau, can do anything. He can put music to anything. Well, let's have him up." So I went up to meet the president of the agency, and it was his idea, and his name was David B. McCall of McCaffrey and McCall. He said, "My little boy can, you know, sing along with Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones, but he can't memorize his multiplication tables." So I had the idea, why not put the multiplication tables to rock music and call it Multiplication Rock? What do you think? And I said, "Well, yeah, that's pretty interesting." And he said, "Well, but don't write down to the kids." Well, I learned later that he had invited other Broadway songwriters to do this task, and they came up with a more simple doggerel type of songwriting, writing down, as it were, to children.
So when he said, "So what do you think?" What did you really think?
I thought, well, yeah, this this could be, you know, a limited idea. But when he added, "Don't write down to children," the hackles on my neck arose, and I got quite intrigued. And so I agreed to tackle it, and I spent about 3 weeks before I would let myself write the first song. I thought first, looked in math books, and since I picked my first title, it was called Three is a Magic Number, I even looked in magic and occult books for the reasons that three might be a magic number.
Did you get anything from those books that
I
you
did,
used
indeed.
In the song? What'd you get?
Mm-hmm. Well, that it was one of the magic numbers, and that it was, embodied in certain things like the Trinity, the old sayings, the heart and the brain and the body, faith, hope, and charity, trinities of sorts. So I got mainly that, trinities. And, of course, I also was an admirer of Buckminster Fuller, so I was thinking of his triangle concept that makes construction so strong.
Well, why don't we pause here and listen to your version, the original version of Three is a Magic Number. Now, did you sing on this one?
Yes.
Okay, why don't we hear it?
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three as a magic number.
Why don't we hear the Blind Melon version of Three is a Magic Number that's included on the new CD, Schoolhouse Rock Rocks.
Three, oh, it's the magic number. Yeah, it is. It's the magic number. Somewhere in that ancient mystic trinity, you'll get three. Magic number. In the past and the present, the future, faith and hope and charity, in the heart and the brain and the body, will give you three. It's a magic number. It takes three legs to make a tripod or to make a table stand, and it takes three wheels to make a vehicle called the tricycle.
Yeah.
And every triangle has three corners, every triangle has three sides. No more.
Now, when the advertising executives ask you to set the multiplication tables to music, had they already known they could broadcast it on ABC TV?
No, they were thinking of a phonograph recording and a book. The idea of television wasn't remotely in their heads.
So how did it get on TV?
Well, after some time of testing the songs and having the product, called Multiplication Rock, they didn't seem to be getting anywhere in the book publishing world, so one of the executives up at McCaffrey & McCall said, you know, one of our clients is ABC Television. I mean, we do their advertising. Why don't we present it to them? And so Mr. Tom Yoey animated it. They did it at their own expense. It's very expensive to animate a 3-minute song. And they presented it as an animation film to ABC, at which point suddenly we were in that business instead of the book business.
Bob Dereau speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1996 interview with Bob Dereau, who was a musical director for Schoolhouse Rock. The music videos that taught kids about grammar, math, and history turned 50 years old last month.
Now, what I'd like to do is play one of my favorites, and it's My Hero Zero. So why don't we play your version and then play the new version on the new CD, Schoolhouse Rock Rocks, and the new version is performed by the Lemonheads. And, well, why don't we play them both? Here we go.
Oh, okay.
And Bob Dereau sings the first version, and of course he wrote the song as well.
My hero, Zero, such a funny little hero, but until you came along, we counted on our fingers and toes. Now you're here to stay, and nobody really knows how wonderful you are, why we could never reach a star without you. My hero, how wonderful you are.
What's so wonderful about a zero? It's nothing, isn't it?
Sure, it represents nothing alone.
But place a zero after one, and you've got yourself a ten. See how important that is.
When you run out of digits, start all over again. See how convenient that is. That's why we'll only 10 digits, including zero. You could count as high as you could ever go. Towards infinity. No one ever gets there, but you can try.
10 billion zeros, from the caveman to the weirdos who invented you. They counted on their fingers and toes.
Or maybe some sticks and stones.
Rocks and bones.
Their neighbor's toes. Yeah, yeah. And nobody really knows how wonderful you are. Oh, you can never reach a star without you. Zero, my hero, zero, how wonderful you are.
Well, Bob Dereau, what do you think of the Lemonheads version of your song, My Hero Zero?
Well, I think it's really quite nice. And, you know, of course, I thought it went the way I went. I like my version better because... I guess it goes with having written the song. Also, that's my daughter doing the second voice on My Hero Zero. She says, Zero? What's so great about a zero? But I love the way the Lemonheads did it, and the whole idea of this new recording is very exciting to me as a songwriter.
Why don't I play Conjunction Junction? Tell me about writing this song. Do you remember?
Well, I must say that my pal, George Newell, he's a musician as well as an art advertising director. He's one of the executives. George Newell gave me the title. We were starting Grammar Rock, and Miss Lynn Ahrens, who's also distinguished herself writing songs for Schoolhouse Rock, she started out the Grammar series. I was still busy with multiplication songs, and she did A Noun is a Person, Place, or Thing, and that was great. But George Newell one day to me said, why don't you tackle this conjunctions. I said, conjunctions? Yeah, those little words. He said, I got an idea for a title, Conjunction Junction. I said, great, I'll take it. So I went home and figured out it was sort of a railroad song, hooking up things like the railroad cars. And I made the song, and we went out to Hollywood to record it, and Dave Frischberg had just written his first song for America Rock at the same time, I'm Just a Bill. So we had a super session in L.A. with Jack Sheldon singing those two songs and me conducting the band and Frischberg playing piano. And we had an all-star jazz band in Hollywood playing Conjunction Junction and I'm Just a Bill. Very exciting.
Conjunction Junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses.
Conjunction Junction, how's that function?
I got three favorite cars that get most of my job done.
Conjunction Junction, what's their function?
I got and, button, or, they'll get you pretty far. And, that's an additive, like this and that. But, that's sort of the opposite, not this, but that. And then there's or, O-R, when you have a choice like this or that. And, button, or, get you pretty far.
Conjunction Junction, what's your function?
Hooking up two boxcars and making them run right. Milk and honey, bread and butter, peas and rice.
Hey, that's nice.
Dirty but happy, digging and scratching, losing your shoe and a button or two. He's poor but honest, sad but true. Boo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo!
Conjunction Junction, what's your function?
Hooking up two cars to one when you say something like this. Choice, either now or later, or no choice. Neither now nor ever.
Hey, that's clever.
Eat this or that, grow thin or fat. Never mind, I wouldn't do that, I'm fat enough now.
Conjunction Junction, what's your function? Hooking
up. Now, do you think most of the people who grew up listening to your songs, do you think that they have any idea that these weren't written and performed by people in advertising agencies or theme houses, that they were written by you, an interesting and eccentric jazz performer, and that the other songs, some of the other songs on here, are sung by interesting and eccentric jazz performers?
Yes, well, I'm sure they didn't even think about such things. They grew up and they learned and they watched. They were a captive audience, one of my partners pointed out, George Newell, because, you know, they were watching Saturday morning cartoons and suddenly there would be this little 3-minute film and they got hooked on them and it actually did them some good. And as we went on in our productions, I kept bringing in some of my buddies from the jazz world. So it was a kind of a a little bit of a underground movement there.
Yeah, well, you brought in Dave Frischberg, the singer and songwriter and pianist, trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon, singer Blossom Dearie.
Yes, Grady Tate,
mm-hmm.
A drummer who sings, or a singer who drums. Excuse me, Grady, I didn't mean it.
What's the difference in the kind of tune that you'd write for one of your own jazz songs and for one of the Schoolhouse Rock songs?
Well, it's more in the beat than the melody. I might do anything for a Schoolhouse Rock song, but it's more apt to be a pop kind of beat instead of a jazz beat. I will tell you about Figure Eight. It was a beautiful little melody. Sounds like a sonata almost. And I used to play it around my house, and my late wife said, "What is that melody?" And I said, "Oh, I was thinking maybe it'd be a song about eight." And she said, "Oh, no, it's too good for Schoolhouse Rock." And I said, "Yeah, you're right." And I wrote a different one, and they didn't like it. So in a bit of desperation, I decided to finish it, and I wrote Figure Eight. And it starts out with this very placid melody. In the middle, it goes into a rock beat where they multiply by eight. But the outside was very dreamy. In fact, we recorded it with a cellist.
Would you sing a few lines of Figure Eight for us?
Figure eight, that's double four. Figure four, that's half of eight. If you skate, you will be great when you can make a figure eight. That's a circle that turns round upon itself.
When you were first getting started musically, I mean, you were really deep into Charlie Parker and wanted to emulate him. And you didn't sing very much because you were afraid that singing would seem corny or too commercial, too showbiz. And so it wasn't until I think you got to Paris in the 50s for a little bit that you actually started singing a lot.
Deep down in my heart, I did want to sing, and I didn't do it as much because I also wanted to be a bebop piano player. And you know, I would never say to one of my colleagues, "Let me sing one." On the other hand, there were occasions where the band got a job and the boss would say, "Does anybody in the band sing?" And, you know, they'd say, "Yeah, the piano player." And, you know, I would do Route 66 or some rhythm tune just to show them that somebody in the band could sing. It was on the Paris job at the Mars Club in Paris that I had full sway and was able to call my own shots. I was the boss. I developed my style or my act sort of there.
Bob Dureau speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. The former musical director for Schoolhouse Rock died in 2018 at age 94. After a break, we listen back to interviews with Dave Frischberg, who wrote the song I'm Just a Bill, and Jack Sheldon, the trumpeter and singer who can be heard on that song, as well as Conjunction Junction. Also, film critic Justin Chang reviews the third movie in the Magic Mike series, Magic Mike's Last Dance. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Figure eight as double four. Figure four as half of eight. If you skate, you would.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure the future of Africa's wildlife and wild lands. Learn more at awf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, professor of television studies at Rowan University, in for Terry Gross. Schoolhouse Rock, the beloved animated music videos with catchy tunes that taught kids about math, grammar, and history, is 50 years old. Today, we're listening back to some of the people who helped write and or perform those songs. One of the classic songs from the series is I'm Just a Bill. It was written by jazz songwriter, pianist, and singer Dave Frischberg, best known for his witty and sophisticated songs about contemporary life, like the song he wrote with Bob Dureau, titled I'm Hip. Frischberg died in 2021. He visited Terry in the studio in 1995, and she asked him to perform I'm Just a Bill.
I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while you're waiting in committee, but I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will, but today I am still just a bill. That was sung by Jack Sheldon in the original recording of that. Listen to this, Terry. A couple of years ago in Portland, a friend of mine was in the hospital.
I went to visit him, and I went to his room, and there was like, he was sharing a room with somebody else who must have been really sick because there was this big screen. I peeked behind the screen, and this other patient was ghastly pale, and he had all kinds of tubes stuck in every orifice. It looked like he was on his way out. So I was talking to my friend, and my friend says, well, what have you been doing? I said, well, I'm working for Schoolhouse Rock again. He says, he says, gee, that thing you wrote years ago, I'm Just a Bill, I still hear that. And from behind the screen came the voice of this other patient, and he said, did you write I'm Just a Bill? And I said, yeah, I said to thin air, you know. And then from behind the screen, he began to sing it, the dying man singing my song, I'm Just a Bill. I was like, oh, God, it was more than I can handle.
Oh, wow, odd. What a strange experience.
Very odd. You know, you never know when. I kept saying, you're singing too much. Just do it conversationally.
Now, when you started to play piano, what did you play?
Boogie Woogie, the blues. I was a blues player. When I was 12 or 13 years old, I was deep into Pete Johnson. He was my hero, Pete Johnson from Kansas City, and Joe Turner. My brother Mort, the guy with the keychain, he used to sing like Joe Turner.
Really?
Yeah, and so he and I would play the Joe Turner, Pete Johnson, Boogie Woogie records, and we would copy them. I would copy them off the record, and we would. That's how I began playing the blues. I could play in C, F, and G, the blues.
Well, I'd love to hear you play something solo at the piano. I mean, to play a piano solo.
Okay.
Tell us what you want to play and why. Well, you've chosen it.
I haven't chosen it. Let me think.
Okay. And while you're thinking, I'll say I really love your piano playing. So when you perform on the show, I always like to get you to play something.
Well, you know, I mentioned Jay McShann. I love that Jay McShann band from Kansas City. I can play a couple of things that I remember from the Jay McShann band, which contained Charlie Parker, by the way, that band did. So Jumpin' Blues, you know. And Walter Brown sang with Jay McShann. That's the Confessing the Blues. That was the stuff that I used to try to play like. I loved McShann's playing, and I loved Count Basie's playing, and Pete Johnson's playing. I was hooked on the Kansas City jazz musicians.
Dave Frischberg visiting Terry Gross in the Fresh Air Studios in 1995. He died in 2021. Coming up, one more musical member of the Schoolhouse Rock family. Trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon can be heard not only on I'm Just a Bill, but on another favorite Schoolhouse song, Conjunction Junction. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century.
This is Fresh Air. It's the 50th anniversary of the ABC TV Schoolhouse Rock music videos, which taught kids about math, history, and grammar using catchy tunes. Jazz musician Jack Sheldon did the singing on two of the most memorable songs from Schoolhouse Rock, I'm Just a Bill and Conjunction Junction. As a big band and recording soloist on trumpet, Jack Sheldon was featured with Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Benny Goodman, Count Basie, and Dizzy Gillespie. His bandmates have included Chet Baker, Art Pepper, and Zoot Sims. His trumpet can be heard on 4 dozen film soundtracks. Jack Sheldon died in 2021. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1993 when he had just released an album of duets called On My Own, featuring Ross Tompkins on piano.
This love of mine goes on and on, though life is empty since you have gone. You're always on my mind, though out of sight. It's lonely through the day, but all the night I cry my heart out. It will surely break, since nothing matters. Just let it break. I ask the sun and the moon, the stars that shine, what's to become of it, this love of mine.
Jack Sheldon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
I don't know why I had this image of you, but I always thought of you as somebody who relied a lot on humor in their singing and music. And there's something so emotionally naked about some of the songs on your new record that really surprised me. I really love the singing and the playing on it. Is the choice of material or the kind of singing that you're doing a relatively recent development with you?
The kind of ballad I've been trying. I think I'm singing better now. I'm studying singing, and so I just can do it better. But I've been doing it all my life, and it's more naked. I think I like that, emotionally naked. That's good.
Well, that's interesting. Tell me what you're getting from learning how to sing. I mean, taking formal lessons.
Well, just real simple stuff, but, to have a lot of foundation, get a lot of air and use your diaphragm, and I notice now when I, if I'm having trouble with a note, it's really because I don't have the foundation there to, get a lot of air in my stomach and my diaphragm and to open my mouth wide. You just learn real simple things that you'd think you'd do, but you don't really, and then practice the pitch and the articulation. It's just things like the trumpet with the hitting every note precisely in pitch, and it's good to take lessons and study like that, because then you do what you do, and then somebody can criticize you, and in a nice way. They're real nice to me, and they're real encouraging.
Was there another change that happened to you besides taking lessons? Did something happen emotionally that left you more open to this kind of material?
Well, I got sober 8 years ago, and I don't drink or take drugs or do anything like that, and I think that left me teachable. Before that, I thought I was really cool, and I knew everything. So, and I didn't want to take lessons. I thought I was better than the teachers, you know, and I really just didn't know what I was doing. And then when I got sober, I found out there was a lot of stuff that I didn't know, and that people didn't use me, not because they didn't like me or anything, because I couldn't produce what they wanted. Now I'm trying to get to be able to do anything any composer might want.
When you were playing in the 1950s, bop was the thing, and very few of the instrumentalists sang. Did you sing back then, and were you self-conscious about singing at all?
Yeah, I was always self-conscious about singing. I wanted to sing, but it's so personal, singing. And I started singing with Benny Goodman's band, and that was about 1958. And I wrote a song, and Benny let me sing. He was the first band leader that would ever let me sing. Stan Kenton wouldn't let me sing, though, because he always was afraid I would say something too off-color, which I probably would have.
Did you have a reputation for doing that?
Yes. I worked with Lenny Bruce, and I was trying to kind of emulate him at the time.
What kind of work did you do with Lenny Bruce? You were in the band playing at the club or something?
Yeah, in burlesque, I worked with Lenny Bruce. We worked with his wife, Honey, and Joe Maney, and Philly Joe Jones, and Kenny Drew, and Leroy Vinegar. We had quite a real good band there. And we played burlesque at a place called Duffy's in Los Angeles. And Lenny was the comic, and we did all kind of, he would write stuff, and we'd act out. We did The Man with the Golden Arm. And
oh, really? Like your own version of that?
Yeah, a burlesque version.
Well, that must have been interesting.
Yeah, it was funny, I think. I think it ended up where the guy flushed the dope down the toilet, and then Lenny said, there's only one thing to do is smoke the toilet. It doesn't sound so funny now. You really had to be there, I guess.
Why don't I play another track from your latest album, On My Own? And I thought I'd play some of I Can't Get Started, because it kind of shows off everything, your trumpet playing, your singing, and it shows both like the emotionalism of your singing and also some of the humor in it, too.
Okay, thanks.
Around the world in a plane, I've settled revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I have charted, still I can't get started with you. Around the golf course I'm under par, and Benny Goodman made me a star. I had a house, a show place. Now she got that, and I got no place. And I also can't get started with you. You're so supreme.
That's Jack Sheldon on trumpet and vocals from his new album, On My Own. There's a really interesting documentary about the trumpeter Chet Baker that you were featured in. You were one of the people interviewed about Baker. And I remember you saying that, and I should mention that like you, Chet Baker played trumpet and sang. And you were very funny about him. You talked a little bit about how frustrating it was that he never, you know, you were always in a room rehearsing, you're practicing, and he never had a practice or anything. He always just had the sound, and he always looked
he
so
did.
Great.
I hear Harry James never had to practice. But I have to practice all the time. Doc Severinsen practices all the time. But, you know, I was singing back there with Chetty when we were little kids, come to think of it. We were both singing, and we'd sing together, and we grew up together. And we would sing. We had a little quartet. We'd go around and play in little bars for $2 or anything we'd get. We just would drive up. The bass player, Hirsch Hamel, had a Pierce Arrow, and we'd have the bass in there, and you know, it was a 12-cylinder old car with a place for a chauffeur and everything.
How old were you then?
Oh, I was about 14, 15. I was about 15. No, 16, I guess.
And how did
you... Because I was in Florida when I was 14. I was 16, and Chetty was about, I think about 18 or 19.
How did you meet?
I think at a place called the Showtime, which was on Sepulveda and Ventura Boulevard. And it was a jam session on Monday nights, and all the guys that were on the road would come in there. I got to play with Art Blakey in there and Stan Kenton and a bunch of people. Maynard Ferguson would come in there, and Chetty and I would always just sit in. To me, it was, you know, the glittering night of stars of jazz, and I was just thrilled to be there.
Now, how did you get to the West Coast from Florida, where you grew up?
Well, my aunt came out here first from Florida, and she was a swimming teacher. Crystal Scarborough was her name, and she taught babies how to swim. And then we moved out here, and my mother started teaching swimming, and I taught swimming, too. And we got a pool on Hollywood Boulevard. My mother taught all the movie stars' kids how to swim. Paul Newman and Lee Remick, all... Every movie star at the time, Nat Cole. I taught Natalie and Kelly Cole how to swim.
Really?
And used to have Kelly in the pool with me, and Nat Cole would be walking around the pool smoking cigarettes. He was a chain smoker. And I'd have Kelly sing, "When the blue of the night meets the gold of the day," you know, Bing Crosby's theme song, and Nat would go, ha, ha, ha. But it was slightly humorous. But I taught a lot of kids. I taught all of Paul Newman's kids. In fact, one of his daughters used to bite me on the ankle when I'd be talking to Joanne Woodward.
How old were you when you started working professionally when you started playing with other bands?
I was 12 in Jacksonville, Florida. And I just started playing the trumpet, and I started working with Gene Brandt's band at the Washington Hotel there. Everybody was gone in the war. And... So I started working, and then I came to California and started college at 16. I started to go to USC, and then I switched over to City College because they had such a good music department. So I went to college there for a couple of years, and then I joined the Air Force. And then I got out of the Air Force, and I worked a lot with Mexican bands. I worked at Million Dollar Theater downtown Los Angeles, all Mexican shows. And... Then I went in the, I joined Stan Kenton and went to New York and played at Birdland with Stan Kenton. And Chet Baker was already there in New York, and he was already acting real wild. He played opposite Miles Davis, and this threw him off. Before he went to New York, he would smoke grass sometimes, but then he got all involved in heroin and everything else in New York. And then... you know, he got really messed up then, and he never really was the same after that, because he was a great kid, and then he got too wild, but he always was a great genius of a trumpet player.
Jack Sheldon, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I'm so flattered you had me on. It's a thrill. I love your show, and it's a great show, and thank you very much.
Musician Jack Sheldon speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. He died in 2021. That concludes our three-interview salute to Schoolhouse Rock on its golden anniversary. And as fans of that show are well aware, three is a magic number. Coming up, film critic Justin Chang reviews the latest movie in the Magic Mike series, Magic Mike's Last Dance. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. It's been more than a decade since Channing Tatum first played a Florida stripper in the movie Magic Mike, directed by Steven Soderbergh. Now, there's a third movie in the series titled Magic Mike's Last Dance. It brings Mike to London and features Salma Hayek-Pinault as his new boss and love interest. Our film critic, Justin Chang, has this review.
Given how little sex or sensuality there is in mainstream American cinema these days, it's no surprise that the Magic Mike movies have been so popular. The first Magic Mike, directed by Steven Soderbergh in 2012, was an irresistible showcase for Channing Tatum and his thong and dance routine, though it was also a sharp, realistic portrait of cash-strapped workers getting by in post-recession Florida. 3 years later, the director Gregory Jacobs leaned into the erotic spectacle of it all with the exuberant Magic Mike XXL, placing women's desires front and center in a way that made even the first movie look staid. Magic Mike's Last Dance, which Soderbergh directed from a script by Reed Carolan, isn't nearly as sexy or as deliriously entertaining as its predecessors, or, I assume, as the Magic Mike live shows that have sprung up in recent years. Still, the new movie does begin with one doozy of a seduction. Mike, his stripping days long behind him, is now working part-time as a bartender in Miami. One evening, he finds himself mixing a drink for a wealthy London-based socialite named Maxandra Mendoza, played with a nice mix of vulnerability and steel by Salma Hayek-Pinault. Max is going through a very messy divorce, and she could use a little distraction. When she finds out, from a mutual acquaintance named Kim, what Mike used to do for a living, she asks how much it would cost for him to give her a private dance.
Nice to meet you.
So, let's say, if you were to do this just like one last time, how much would something like that go for?
How much would something like that go for? 60,000, maybe?
$60,000?
Yeah, 60. Let's call it 60.
What the f*** are you doing? She said it was a silly dance.
Who said that? Kim said that? It was silly?
Yeah, she said it was a silly dance, but that it would get my mind off of things. And if she's right, I'm willing to pay six.
What? You're serious right now? You're gonna pay me $6,000 to give you a dance?
Yeah, but no happy endings, huh?
And so Mike gives her what she asks for, starting with a lap dance and building to what looks like an elaborate home gymnastics routine. There's a funny bit beforehand where he tests out the furniture to make sure it can support the weight of his acrobatics. The dance scene is gorgeous and hypnotic, and it whets your appetite for more. But then the movie takes a surprising turn. Max, impressed by the passion and artistry of Mike's dancing, asks him to come back to London with her. There, he'll take over as director of a play at the theater that she now owns as part of her separation agreement. The play is a dreary-looking period drama called Isabel Ascendant, and Max thinks it needs a massive contemporary overhaul, with more heat and more urgency, and yes, an ensemble of male strippers. And so she and Mike begin recruiting the best and hottest dancers they can find, none of whom have ever stripped in public before, though they're game enough to give it a try. Magic Mike's Last Dance has an infectious let's-put-on-a-show energy, plus some wry family drama, courtesy of Jamelia George as Max's sarcastic teenage daughter. Meanwhile, as Max's divorce proceedings continue, her relationship with Mike becomes its own complication. The possibility of long-term romance didn't really factor into the first two Magic Mike movies, which were all about fleeting transactional encounters. I guess that makes Magic Mike's Last Dance the more mature, thoughtful entertainment, and I'm not sure that's entirely a good thing. Don't get me wrong, Tatum and Hayek-Pinault have an on-screen chemistry that's both romantic and collaborative. Their characters' creative back and forth becomes a vision of gender parity in action. Max wants to thrill her play's female audience, but she needs Mike's smarts and expertise to do it. Still, there's something a little too dutiful, and even dull, about the way the character's mutual attraction ultimately plays out. Soderbergh has always liked to subvert expectations. And here he seems bent on short-circuiting a lot of the pleasures we've come to expect from the Magic Mike movies. The dancing and the stripping feel tamer this time around. We don't really get to know the dancers as characters, and I missed the raunchy male camaraderie of Mike's old stripper buddies, played by actors like Matt Bomer and Joe Manganiello, who appear in just one brief scene. At the same time, there's something fitting about how muted and even melancholy this movie feels. As the title suggests, Magic Mike's Last Dance is about a guy bidding farewell to his calling and passing the baton to the next generation. Stripping was never his dream job, but it was good for him while it lasted, and also for us.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed Magic Mike's Last Dance.
What do you get when you fall in love? A guy with a pin to burst your bubble.
On Monday's show, we remember composer and arranger Burt Bacharach, who died Wednesday at the age of 94. His collaborations with lyricist Hal David during the 1960s included many hits sung by Dionne Warwick, including Anyone Who Had a Heart, Walk On By, and I Say a Little Prayer. They also wrote The Look of Love, This Guy's in Love with You, and many other songs. We'll listen to our interviews with Bacharach and David, and with Bacharach and Elvis Costello, who also collaborated with him. I hope you can join us. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Don't tell me what it's all about, 'cause I've been there and I'm glad I'm out. Out of those chains that bind you. That is why I'm here to remind you what to do.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California and North Carolina or from all agents. And from Carla Itzkovich, whose gift in memory of Moises Itzkovich, founder of the Moises Itzkovich Foundation, helps provide public radio news and information to communities around the world.